prospect of Russia emerging as global economic shock. It is now universally acknowledged that no country can survive on its own. Experience underscores the imperative for a country to establish relations with other nations. Thus, if the Soviet Union cannot maintain economic progress under autarky, it would be impelled to search for foreign markets to dispose of its industrial surplus. This became abundantly evident during the war, when the Soviet Union had to rely heavily on imports of essential goods from America and Great Britain. If it maintains its pace of industrialization, the Soviet Union would have to find new markets for its producers. When that day arrives, would the Russian policy not assume the same characteristics and adopt the same methods as we have seen in the history of other imperial powers? To put it plainly, Russia would be compelled to make other countries, by some means or other, to buy Russian products in order to keep its labor employed and sustain its economic and industrial growth. Experience of other imperialist powers. We have seen that when it concerns granting India independence, rousing speeches are made in the Houses of Parliament, but when it concerns economic progress, the experts start pronouncing on the need for protecting the British interests. No doubt, Russia's case would be quite similar, though with one important difference. In the case of Great Britain and America, it is the private firms that compete, but in the case of Russia, it will be the entire socialist system that would compete with the individual foreign trader. It will not willingly close its factories and allow unemployment to rise in the face of foreign competition, but it will adopt all means to make other countries buy its products. And it will direct the entire might of its state, which owns factories and wields total political power, towards achieving that end. The economically weak neighboring countries would be particularly vulnerable to the Soviet pressure. At that point, Russia would use all tactics that the big investors employ under capitalism. Since industry in Russia is under state control, the clout of the political power will also be wielded. At that stage, Russia would not just be concerned with protecting its commercial interests, it would also seek to raise the standard of its industry, protect its labor and factories, and attract foreign capital. Thus, the neighboring economies would end up opening their economies to Soviet goods, as they did for the Western capitalists. But this time, it would be a bigger economic shock for the world. Sometimes an argument is made that the vulnerable countries could escape the onslaught of Russian competition by becoming allies of the Soviet Union and gain all the advantages of the communist system. But a little reflection would establish that this idea is not sound. In the first place, we should not forget that not many countries would put aside all other considerations aside and rush to join the Soviet Union simply to capture some economic gains. The communists in various countries would, of course, be glad to see the Soviet system introduced everywhere, but it seems doubtful that many would submit their economies to Russian dictates. This would apply to communists in Great Britain and America, and to those of practically every other country. They have a preference, no doubt, for the Soviet system, but they are not eager at all to let Moscow run their country's affairs. I cannot say anything about the thinking of Indian communists. We know from experience that they are not given to thinking through important issues, and generally are not well educated. They are fond of sloganeering, but few understand the implications of their slogans. Many put thought and reflection aside and get carried away by their emotions. It is possible that a large majority of the Indian communists would not object to India being absorbed into the Soviet Union, but communists in the rest of the world are not so inclined and believe that such a situation would bring about ruin and destruction for their countries. Absence of equality in Russian-occupied territories. We should also observe that the quality of life enjoyed by European Russians differs significantly from that of people living in the Soviet territories outside Europe. I would meet all expenses if the Communist Party were to let one member of my community visit Soviet Union and show to him that the poor in Bukhara have everything that the poor in Moscow have, in terms of housing, clothing, food, education, and medical care. I am sure an inspection of life in the two towns would show that there is an appalling difference in the degree of well-being enjoyed by their inhabitants. The same observation applies to the other Russian territories in Asia. Only recently, an official announcement was made regarding schemes to ameliorate conditions in these territories, and that a special program would be devised for future progress there. This statement should help to dispel the delusion that Soviet Russia treats its Asian citizens as well as its European citizens. Had this been so, the European and Asian territories of the Soviet Union would have reached a similar economic status. Some people believe that because communism is based on the principle of equality, the system would not betray itself by usurping the rights of the weak. This idea is no more than a delusion. The Russian reticence till now in economic competition and in scramble for foreign territories has not been due to any ethical sense of right or wrong, but simply from the inability to assert its power. These policies will undergo a radical transformation as soon as it becomes strong enough to impose its will. In fact, the change can already be observed. So long as Russia was preoccupied with domestic politics, Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia were free and independent. Russia boasted that it did not get involved in the internal affairs of other countries, and that in pursuit of liberation, it had granted independence to all countries that so desired, namely Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, Finland, Poland, and Georgia. It had also handed over Turkey a portion of Armenia that was originally a part of Turkey. But as soon as domestic unrest abated, Georgia was incorporated into the Soviet Union. On gaining further strength, it started to dispute Finland's border. This process continued until the Soviet Union came to occupy Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. Portions of Romania, too, were nibbled off, and Finland was overpowered, and some parts of it were incorporated into the Soviet Union, leaving the rest of the country independent. Poland is quietly appropriated now. Russia has proclaimed publicly that a government that does not support its policies would not be tolerated at its borders. Only governments that are prepared to remain loyal and subservient to Moscow can remain in power in these countries. Under the cloak of security, there has been Russian interference in the affairs of Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. Schemes have been set afoot to grab the oil fields in Persia. Turkey is being called upon to hand back portions of Armenia ceded to it earlier, and Moscow has openly sought control of the Dardanelles. Did the old imperial governments do anything different in their days of glory? Did they not, in fact, proceed more gently and tactfully? Were they not less blunt and less brutal? To be sure, Great Britain too has had an interest in the Dardanelles for a long time, but it never applied the degree of pressure on Turkey as Russia has done in just a few years. With this evidence, it is not wise to believe that Russia would not force its neighboring countries into economic subjugation in the same way as the European traders did with the help of their governments. Events have proved that as soon as Russia gained power, its claims of political equality and freedom went by the board. There is now no basis for accepting Russia's claim that it has no interest in other countries. Upon entering the world of politics, communism changed its ideology and disregarded its own principles in favor of advancing its own interests. Georgia, Bukhara, Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia have all been occupied and brought under its political authority. Schemes are being prepared to gain influence in Iran and Turkey, and for the breakup of China. Can the occupation and subjugation of these countries be called equality and freedom of conscience? Why would Finland permit that a part of its territory be absorbed into Russia? Why was the freedom of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia trampled underfoot? Why was it necessary that these countries should sacrifice their own independence to safeguard White Russia? Was it incumbent upon Georgia and Bukhara to get incorporated into the Russian Empire? If this was for the cause of liberty and freedom, why did the opposite not take place? Why was not a part of Russia handed over to Finland and other parts given to Poland, Romania, Turkey, and Iran to strengthen their defenses? Surely from the viewpoint of security, these smaller countries merited additional territory more than Russia did. The fact is that Russia remained unaggressive only as long as it lacked the power. Once it gained the power, Russia did not hesitate to devour the smaller states on grounds that it needed to strengthen its borders. If this were a valid reason, it could also be used by America to justify retaining control over the Japanese islands. The reality is that those with power can always present excuses to justify their actions. As they say, might is right. Given this record of the Russian approach in international politics, how can we hope that Russia would take a more egalitarian and just approach in the economic sphere? For those who think that political decisions are different from economic decisions, the question can be posed differently. If Russia really loves equity, why does it seek to occupy Iran's oil fields? Is this fair to Iran, considering that the country itself needs oil to support its poor and hungry people? If the interests and welfare of the weak have any value in Russia's eyes, as the communists claim, then Russia should have, for example, lent money to Iran free of interests so that Iran could develop its oil resources. It should be obvious, then, that the objective of Russia is to deprive Iran of the benefit of its oil fields to promote its own interests. Some people argue that the British too have taken possession of Iran's oil fields. This is not a good argument, because the wrong done by one does not justify the same for someone else. If Britain is to be condemned for its actions, one should also condemn Russia. Russian actions demonstrate that its policies are in reality no different from the policies followed by other imperial powers. If Russia subscribes to the principle of equality, it should hand over oil fields of Baku to Iran on the ground that Iran must have the same rights as Russia. But Russia has no interests in such equality. Russia is still at an early stage of industrialization. When it has advanced, we can expect to see that it would promote its industrial interests in other countries in a manner that has not been witnessed before. The reason is that communism has only crushed individual capitalism, but it has nurtured and promoted collective capitalism, which is a very dangerous development. America passed the antitrust laws precisely to curb this kind of development. State capitalism more dangerous than earlier imperialists. Experience shows that individual businesses are never as successful as companies, and companies are never as successful as trusts, and trusts are never as powerful as cartels. But companies that are backed or owned by state, as in the case in Russia, could assume power that no individual companies or even weak economies can achieve. Smaller economies, and even bigger economies, can manage to deal with individual private companies, but the state-run collective capitalism is altogether a different matter. Large industrial countries always sought economic influence in small and weak economies, but it still remained possible for such countries to have their own capitalists. Because competition was between individuals, some businesses in smaller countries could withstand the competition from the bigger and better organized enterprises. Great Britain is one of the most highly industrialized countries, but that did not deter firms in Holland, Belgium, and Switzerland to compete with British firms, simply because the competition was between firms rather than countries. To put it differently, the British Army can be expected to prevail over, say, Belgium in a confrontation, but every individual British soldier may not be able to overcome every Belgian soldier. Private capitalism does have its dangers, but it does leave the weak some breathing space. However, when pitted against state capitalism, the weaker and smaller economies have little chance of survival. This is analogous to an army equipped with only clubs having to take on an army equipped with machine guns. But state capitalism, under which the entire economic and political might of one country is pitted against individual traders and manufacturers of another country, threatens to destroy the world economic order. In short, Russian communism has raised the prospect of a very dangerous form of capitalism, and there are only two ways to deal with that threat. One possibility is that the entire world adopts the same economic system and becomes a part of the Soviet Union, thereby ending the competition between unequal. Is there any possibility that such a development will take place? Would Great Britain, America, and France be prepared to join the Soviet Union so that they could escape the onslaught of Russian competition? Even if that were conceivable, would this ensure that they would gain rights and privileges similar to those enjoyed by Russians themselves? Since that is unlikely, this really is no solution. The other solution could be for each country to adopt the communist system, but retains its independence. If this were to happen, it would mean that state-owned enterprises would be pitted against each other, a situation that would be even more dangerous. While individual enterprises of one country competed with individual enterprises of another country earlier, the state enterprise of one country would now compete with the state enterprise of another. Were this eventuality to materialize, we would face continuous warfare instead of occasional wars, relieved by varying periods of peace. Commercial caravans would move across the globe, but would it require armed forces to defend them? Trade and commerce would be conducted between government officials and not company managers. In such a world, smaller and weaker countries would lose their independence and end up turning into hunting grounds for the bigger, more powerful countries. The major industrial powers would continue to compete, but the competition would be between governments, not the individual firms. It is no more than a delusion to suppose that when such a stage is reached, people everywhere would rise to the occasion and conclude a just and lasting peace. Russia today is not prepared to share its wealth with the less fortunate. There is no reason to expect that things will be different when it becomes wealthier. If it were disposed that way, it would not have set its eyes on controlling Iran's oil fields. Russian claims of equality among nations bellied by its actions. By joining the Big Three, Russia has clearly deviated from its stated principle of equality among nations. Where do the smaller and weaker nations stand against the Big Three? No more than a weakling confronting a wrestler. If communist Russia were true to principle of absolute equality, it should have sided with the weak nations and insisted that it would not accept any difference in treatment among nations. If men are equal as individuals, that is equal in their rights as human beings, then it follows that all countries, no matter whether they be big or small, are equal in their rights and are entitled to their own healthy and happy life, safe from interference and humiliation. Russia should have asserted the principle in intergovernmental bodies that all governments, weak and powerful, must have equal voice in protecting their rights. But Russia did not do so, and agreed to settle all important issues through consultations among the big three. By its action, Russia demonstrated that its voice must carry greater weight than the voice of smaller countries, such as Belgium and Holland. If nations could not have equal rights, how could individuals expect equal treatment? Surely, moral and ethical standards must not differ in their application to individuals and nations. Thus, Russia's claim of equality has no substance and is mere show. If a big government deserves preferential treatment, why should an expert technician or trader not have an advantage over an inexperienced technician or trader? Giving preferential treatment to a larger country could in fact be more harmful than allowing an individual to excel because of his special skills. Any inequality which is created can be redressed with Islam's fine principles as discussed above. This brings to mind an incident concerning one of India's leaders, when several Indian political leaders gathered to deliberate on some matters. The late Sir Sikandar Hayat Khan and Sir Feroz Khan Noon invited me to take part in the meeting, which was held at Simla, and was attended by about 70 or 80 leaders from all over the country. One of the leaders was rather annoyed with the size of the assembly, and said in his speech that such important matters could not conveniently be discussed or settled in large gatherings. He then proposed that only the leaders of leaders should meet and let others know of the decision. This is exactly Russia's position, that the decisions reached by the big three should be accepted by all others who lack the right to participate in these meetings. The sole reason for this is that Russia is a military power, while countries like Belgium, France, and Holland are less powerful. If the military might is the only reason for giving weight to Russia's voice, it seems highly unlikely that Russia would be prepared to accept others in its economic program. A country that accords little value to other countries' views concerning peace cannot be expected to provide food and clothing to them. Once its industry advances, Russia can be expected to seek mandates over its markets instead of equal participation. In short, the Soviet Union does not really stand for death to capitalism. That is only an illusion in the minds of some people. Its real slogan is, death to capitalism where individuals own property, and long live the state capitalism of Russia. The consequence of the state of affairs can be predicted. It was possible to withstand the power and influence of individual capitalists, but nobody would be able to compete with the state-run capitalism. Barriers to foreign influences in Russia. It seems that Russia is aware of its basic weakness and tries to shield itself by restricting contacts with foreign countries. In an article published in the June issue of the Soviet Union, Mr. Stephen King Hall, a member of the British Parliament, reported his impressions based on his recent visit to Russia. He wrote that the Russian government did not wish that the Russian people should be exposed to Western ideas or thinking. He went on to say that it was only through official channels, not directly, that one could get an idea of the Russian way of life, and that this state of affairs would continue for some time. Russian isolation was evident during the recent visit of a group of Russian experts who came along with some Americans to this country. The Russians were surprised to find that in India one could travel freely, while in their own country people had little money to travel on their own. They felt as though they had been transported to a different world. This instance reflected Russia's lack of exposure to other countries. Obviously, the Russians cannot be kept in cold storage indefinitely. One day the wall of isolation would crumble and the world would witness a profound transformation. Russian claims of practicing equality among its citizens are not credible. I have my doubts about equality in Russia, but since the information about the actual situation is very scanty, one cannot be sure. I do know that ordinary Russian soldiers wear worn-out uniforms. I have learned this from our Ahmadi officers and soldiers who were posted in places where they had contact with the Russian army. According to them, the uniforms worn by the soldiers from the Asian part of the Soviet Union were particularly shabby. By contrast, the uniforms worn by Russian marshals, as can be seen from their pictures in the newspaper, are elegant, resplendent with very expensive medals. The cost of these medals alone dispels any notion of equality in the Soviet Union. The state of equality in Russia can be gauged from a banquet Mr. Stalin gave in honor of Mr. Churchill when he visited Moscow during the war. Mr. Churchill, upon his return to England, said that he wished his capitalist country could afford to feed him on the same sumptuous scale as he had seen in a country with a proletarian government. if equality really exists in Moscow, does an ordinary Russian get the same lavish dinners as are offered at state banquets? If not, it is evident that Russia has not resolved the problem of inequality, nor is there a prospect that it will in the future. The lavishness displayed at state banquets cannot be rationalized on grounds of necessity. During the war, state banquets in England were quite simple. Russia could have kept the banquet simple, but the real motivation was to impress Mr. Churchill with Russia's grandeur. It is this attitude that frustrates the spirit of quality. This incident also suggests that the notion of equality itself has undergone change over time, and a new class of rich is emerging that is rooted in the power and influence within the Communist Party. In short, inequality persists in the Soviet Union, but its form has changed. While reviewing the manuscript for the speech, I came across a piece of news relating to the absence of equality in Russia. I reproduce it below because it throws light on the subject and lends support to my assessment. It was reported by the Canberra correspondent of The Sun, a well-known Australian newspaper, that the Australian ambassador to Russia gave a statement before a parliamentary party during his holidays in which he stated, 1. A new class of wealthy people is emerging in Russia because the influential members of the Communist Party, as well as those considered technical experts, get far better treatment than ordinary people. Number 2. In restaurants, the food served is graded into 5 classes, tickets for which can be obtained according to party influence or the nature of a person's job. Number 3. In consequence, the difference among individuals is as evident today as it was during Tsarist Russia. Number 4. While in other countries the black market is run by shadier segments of society, in Russia it is in the hands of the authorities themselves. Number 5. As a consequence, important people can obtain whatever they wish, while the ordinary laborer has to do without many necessities of life. The Australian ambassador subsequently expressed regret at the publication of the report on the ground that it was likely to upset Australia's relations with Soviet Russia. However, he did not contradict it. This suggests that the expression of regret was politically motivated and was not a contradiction of the statement itself. This report also confirms my expectations regarding the future of Russia as described earlier. It was inevitable that a new class of wealthy people would emerge in Russia, for the differences in individuals' capacity and caliber cannot be ignored. Because communism lacks the restraints on power, privilege, and wealth, as ordained in Islam, the new class is bound to drag communist governments to the old ways. The only consequence of the communist revolution would be to give Russia a prominent place among imperialist nations in exploiting the profitable opportunities wherever available. The hope of a proletarian world government would turn into an unrealizable dream. This is so because communist philosophy was not anchored in human sympathy, but into the goal of settling scores with the Tsarist government. Unanswered questions about claims of equality. I would like to say something here about the moral and cultural standard of the ordinary Russian soldiers. I learned of the case of a train carrying drums of benzene oil through Iran. When one of the drums leaked, some Russian soldiers mistook it for rum or beer and started drinking it. About 1,000 Russian soldiers ended up drinking benzene, which resulted in the death of dozens of soldiers while hundreds were taken ill. It was a display of total lack of commitment to national service. The soldiers forgot their sense of duty and responsibility to protecting their country's property, meaning the benzene. It also shows that the soldiers assigned in Iran were not paid enough to resist temptation, and they had not benefited from Russia's economic progress. With respect to Russian industry, the question arises whether the nature of work is similar in every industry. Clearly, a coal miner's work is quite different from that of a shopkeeper. Similarly, a tailor's needs for capital are different from the needs of a man who wants to start working as a jeweler. How does communism propose to resolve these differences? Does the government own all the capital of the shopkeepers and control all their transactions? Further, is an incompetent doctor or a lawyer entitled to charge the same fees as other doctors and lawyers? If the fees can vary according to ability, how can the presumed claim of equality be established? And if the best doctor or lawyer cannot charge a higher fee, why would everyone not rush to them for service? In this case, how can they attend to everyone? In short, as soon as the communist principle of equality is put into practice, a host of questions arise. We are not in a position to know how these questions may be answered in Russia, but so long as satisfactory answers are not forthcoming, the conclusion must remain that the communist proponents of equality are wrong in their claims.